And Up's gonna admit everybody in. Hi everyone, welcome to our session. We're just letting everyone in and we'll get started pretty quickly. Give folks some time. I see some of my colleagues popping up. Hi. And as we're waiting for folks to show up, if you'd like to introduce yourself in the chat, that would be awesome. You can say your name and where you're from, that would be great. And if you haven't already, go ahead and make sure that your mic is turned off. If you want to turn your camera off or on, that's fine. Okay, looks like most folks have been able to make it into the room. I would like to welcome everybody to our session today. This is the 15th annual Ilago Isle Summit. I can't believe it's been 15 years that this event has been going on. We're so excited to have you here today. My name is Amy Stanforth. I'm a librarian at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. And I'm joined today with my two colleagues from Ilago, Bronwyn Maxson and Sarah Robertson. I just want to thank them both for helping to organize this session and for all your hard work. I have a little agenda for us today. I'm gonna start our session with a land acknowledgement, and then we'll have three presentations. First up is gonna be Andrew Wang and Kate Thornhill, and they will be presenting about functional and subject specialists collaborating in the remote classroom. Then Kate will talk to us about talking stories and open pedagogy collaboration and partnership. And then Garrett Trott will present to us about transparent library instruction. At the end of our three presentations, we'll have some question and answer time. For our question and answer time, please go ahead and submit your questions into the chat box. And at the end, we'll go through and ask each of our presenters those questions. And because we do have three presentations, be sure to indicate who exactly your question is for. And yeah, I think that does it. And yeah, you get a message when you've come into the room that we are recording this session. So just to let everyone know that that is happening as well. So I'll go ahead and read our land acknowledgement for today. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I work in downtown Portland. So this land acknowledgement is from my own perspective. And Portland State University is located in the heart of downtown Portland, Oregon in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Columbia River. It's important to acknowledge the ancestors of this place and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants. This land acknowledgement comes to us from the Native American Student and Community Center. And I have added a link to this slide, native-land.ca, so that each of our participants and everyone in this session today can go to that link and see who the Indigenous people of their homelands are as well. So I encourage you all to visit that and to get to know more about that. So for our first session, I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing my screen, and I'm going to ask Kate and Andrew to go ahead and bring theirs up, and then we'll get started with our first presentation. So Kate and Andrew.
Awesome. Thanks, Amy. Okay, let's do the share. All right. Is everyone able to see my screen okay? Give me like a virtual or a video thumbs up. Cool. Awesome. All right, Andrew, are you ready?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Sweet. All right. Hello, everyone. Nice to have all of you here. Today, Andrew Wang and I will be presenting on functional and subject specialists collaborating in the virtual classroom at the University of Oregon. So let's give some background and context for how the faculty and myself and Andrew connected. So first, I'm Kate Thornhill. I am the Digital Scholarship Librarian at UO, and my responsibilities include digital scholarship instruction and digital scholarship instruction and research with a focus and emphasis on the digital humanities. I lead DH-centric workshops at the UO libraries, and that's where a lot of the times I start engaging in conversations and understanding the DH needs of faculty members. So back in the fall term, I was able to connect with a faculty member in the College of Design through one of our workshops, our WordPress workshops. And in addition to that, I'm also the lead volunteer digital archivist for historical collections and archives for a nonprofit in Eugene, Oregon, called the Eugene Masonic Cemetery Association. So Andrew, I will kick it off back to you.
And then my background, I started at UO last January, so I was new and very grateful for Kate kind of connecting me to the faculty member, especially because they are in Portland, and I'm doing liaison work with them and able to travel because of COVID. But my background is in instructional design. I was at Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota before I got here. And I also have a background in art history. So it was a nice marriage of the different interests that we had. And then Chad Randall is a faculty in the College of Design. He is the faculty member who reached out to Kate through that WordPress workshop. And he teaches 20th century architectural surveys. He works with historic preservation primarily, and he examines culture of building conservation. He's interested in incorporating technology and considering how people inhabit spaces. So he's very people-centric. So for the role of us combining our powers, Kate really has a good handle on the digital tools and how they communicate. What exactly they're trying to communicate. Kate's really great at identifying what is necessary. Whereas I brought my subject expertise to the table, and I think that we combined our powers and really focused on user-centered design, using our backgrounds and also taking into account what the faculty member wanted. And we both also teach and have a lot of different experience in instructional design and information literacy and visual literacy and digital literacy, all the literacies. And Kate Thornhill actually has a background in art too. So she really is like the go-to person. And I was just really grateful to be able to work with her. And then in the end, I think we created a lot of holistic research support for the students, whether they were looking for content for whatever project they were working on, or they just needed help finding a tool or making a tool work for them. So a nice little summary of like an outline of what we did. Our library instruction session connected with a graduate level 20th century architectural survey course. This was completely remote, though usually the program takes place in Portland. So in any case, we probably would have done this remotely anyway, now that I'm thinking about it. But we were kind of forced to, given the circumstances. So there was one, we had one meeting with a faculty member where Chad just basically filled us in on what he was interested in. And then Kate and I met twice just to hash out everything we were gonna do with a total of about 8 hours of time just preparing for the course or the class. So then we developed a pre-class module in Canvas, and we also had an hour and a half remote session that included an icebreaker, breakout activity, and class discussion, which we will get more into.
So what was this actual course assignment that the faculty member wanted us to be able to support? So with this graduate level class, this was a term-based project that Chad wanted all the faculty to prepare a main digital project that introduces the public to a particular building or site constructed during a specific time period that they were studying during the quarter. So the requirement was 20th century. This project, it could have been a website, it could have been a video tour, it could have been an interactive app, it could have been a brochure. It was very, very broad and very open to what that format was. But ultimately, this project was meant to be able to communicate and explore how architectural knowledge and historical methods are translated for various audiences. And accompanying the project, the students were also required to write a short paper interpreting benefits and drawbacks that this format or the shape of the tool that the students were using for sharing information about these historical places or buildings.
And now I'll go over the lesson planning brainstorming that we did, but I really want to focus on the learning outcomes, which will be on the following slide. But just for some context, there were about 20 students, mostly graduate students, and a few upper level undergrads. We had originally 60 minutes for our synchronous session, but it turned into a full hour and a half with the faculty members' blessing, I guess. If you want to learn more about what Chad wanted specifically, you can read those, but I think we're going to shift gears to the learning objectives. So since we had two different components to this, we developed learning outcomes for the asynchronous session and the live instruction session. For the asynchronous, we really wanted students to get introduced to the goals of the Hope Abbey Mausoleum. So we wanted them to be able to articulate that, and we'll talk about assessment later. The second one for asynchronous was having students navigate and find relevant data about demographics in Eugene. So really thinking about what the board wants and also what the population that the tool would be serving, what they would want.
Yeah, and additionally, to give some context, what is the Hope Abbey Mausoleum? So Andrew and I specifically brought to the course content related to the 20th century, and the Hope Abbey Mausoleum is a mausoleum that's located at Eugene Masonic Cemetery. So the building that we were working with in this class specifically was coming directly from a topic that was covered in the class and from an active nonprofit in Eugene. So after we determined the async learning outcomes, we were trying to think through how could we scaffold the learning outcomes into the live session? So for our live session learning outcomes, we wanted to make sure that students were able to articulate what kind of human computer interactions they would actually what they would like for their audiences as part of this this outreach project. We also wanted students to be able to argue how they think a digital tool would be able to support the outreach to a specific demographic. And then we constructed essentially a digital tools directory that we linked from Canvas, but it was built using a free tool called Airtable. Our intention for the Airtable we'll get into in some following slides, but really as a space for students to be able to explore different digital tool options that were available to them. And then finally, for the live instruction session on Zoom, it was really how could students create additional questions to help identify these additional needs that were required by their audiences to have an effective outreach tool. So the asynchronous instruction activities on Canvas and the live session on Zoom. So for the asynchronous content-wise, like what do we actually have the students do? We created a Canvas module where we had students read through some historical like background information about the Eugene Masonic Cemetery Association. And then we had them create some open, we had them do some reflective open responses using a discussion board to highlight what are these user needs. And Andrew created this really great module using the Esri zip lookup tool where students were able to go and type in Eugene's zip code and see actually how like the demographics of Eugene actually look like. And for our live instruction session, we had our icebreaker using Padlet. We were using Airtable. We were having students also engage in breakout groups on Zoom. We had a Google Doc for worksheets and also a whole segment of the class to do a project pitch.
So now we're going to talk a little bit more about the meat of the content of our instruction session. And hopefully you'll see how it's scaffolded, and it sounds like a lot when it's all separate, but it kind of like builds on top of each other. So we started off with this icebreaker activity because it really connected with the Esri zip lookup tool asynchronous module, where they were challenged to go find demographics and psychographic information about the populations. So they're already thinking about people-centered design. With this breakout icebreaker activity, we had students look at the two images that you can see on the top left. It's the interior of the Barcelona Cathedral and also an exterior shot. And the prompt was basically, how would you want to experience this as it's mediated through a computer screen? And students came up with a whole wide variety of responses. And there's we're including a link at the end of this. So if you want to read a little bit more about that, you're welcome to later.
And then the Airtable. So the intention of this Airtable was to introduce digital tools matching the purposes of what their user goals were. So with this directory, we were asking students to identify what, first off, what did they know how to use and what did they not know how to use? And with all of the examples of these digital tools in this Airtable, we did ask students to go and explore them because there were digital projects connected to them. So they were able to go and investigate StoryCorps does this, Omeka does that, WordPress does X, Y, and Z. And so after we had them working through the Airtable, we had an activity where the students were put back into their groups and having to form a pitch. What Andrew and I did was in this activity, we actually had the students make a pitch to me and Andrew as mock board members of EMCA. And so we were asking students to identifying who is your audience and addressing those functional need requirements for that digital tool you were using. And the students had to take notes and then present this project to me and Andrew. What was really cool about this process was that many students were asking questions about accessibility and, thinking about their demographics for like older audiences that maybe need like hearing aid devices. And also thinking about, when building digital projects, like if you're like beyond the catch-all public audience and trying to get more specific about, who actually is your target audience when you are designing this digital research project.
And then some of our key findings at the end of this, we found that students had a lot of success in talking about the high level issues and specific components of human computer interaction that they wanted for their specific outreach projects. They also selected and discussed why a specific tool would be appropriate and also consider the stakeholder questions. So the way that Kate and I kind of grilled them at the end of this in the discussion really prompted them to reevaluate what they had come to decide as a group. And then they also had the opportunity to ask each other as well. So there was some nice peer review going on, or not peer review, but peer feedback. And then they also asked a lot of really great questions about other tools and how it related to specific community members. And then they also asked questions about accessibility, as Kate mentioned. One person mentioned The idea of navigating the cemetery with an app on their phone, and then we talked about like, well, who would that be for then? Are there certain people who wouldn't be able to access that space physically or electronically even? And then some of the challenges that we found, the students were supposed to focus specifically on the mausoleum, but a lot of them talked about the entire cemetery. It's still, I think the concept still translated, but in the future, I think we'd want to be more specific about like, hey, we're talking about the mausoleum. The research project scopes were also very large for a 10-week project. So at the end of this, they're not expected to create like a fully fleshed out digital exhibition or an app, anything to that extent. What they were really doing was creating a draft or like a framework for what they would create, essentially a plan. But then, you know, on top of that, because it was only a 10-week project and they were creating a draft, a lot of the students weren't really considering what the needs of the nonprofit would be moving forward. So that technical debt, like who would be working on it, and also like the financial considerations. If they're going to invest in creating a project, is it going to be maintainable over time? There was also a lot of tools to pick from, especially if folks didn't know any of them, if they were just getting started for the first time in this arena. And also getting into the weeds about data management really did transform the research project scopes. Some people kind of shot very high in the sky with their ambitions, which is fantastic. But of course, the reality is that they would have to scale back. And I think communicating that with students and really letting them know that this is the scope of their project would have been probably more comforting, I would say. So how was learning assessed? I think this is kind of like the good meaty stuff. For the asynchronous session, we had talked about the learning outcome of articulating what the board members wanted. So the evidence, the acceptable evidence for that would have been if students were able to actually describe a specific initiative or value from the assigned readings and then explain it and describe how it speaks to the interests of a particular population. And everybody chose different populations for the most part and came up with really creative answers. So for instance, like a music type of program centered for an older population versus like family friendly types of events. They had completely different answers, and it was great because the students could see how their peers were responding, and it was open-ended. And then the other learning outcome was finding that relevant data and demographics for Eugene, Oregon. So this was a fairly simple walkthrough with instructions on how to navigate Esri lookup, the Esri Zip Lookup tool. And they basically just completed a brief multiple choice quiz to make sure that they actually knew how to, you know, get around all the weird quirks of that tool.
And then for the in-person, live on Zoom, we had four learning outcomes associated with that lesson plan. And so for the learning outcome of articulating what kind of human-computer interaction that we wanted the students to be able to articulate for their outreach project, this exploration of tools, after doing that, students were able to explain to Andrew and me what specific functions were required to make their project idea successful. With the arguing for what kind of digital tool would support a specific demographic, we were able to gain evidence of the student success through their actual presentation of the presentations they gave about the application of the tool and how it would support a specific audience. So this is all done through note-taking in Google Docs. And then with the Canvas and the Airtable, the students were able to locate it in Canvas, and they all were able to select a tool or two that they could talk about and justify. And then finally, with the creation of additional questions, all of them had questions for us and also questions for each other, which was really neat with the final discussions that we were all having at the end of the class. So our second to last slide, the benefits of our collaboration. So Andrew and I are teaming up more for consultations and instruction opportunities. We've had a few of them with the same faculties, different from Chad, to figure out how we could bring digital and information literacy to their classroom using Canvas. And then the faculty, Chad, is really interested in collaborating with us more. During the class, we had students following up with us after the class for research consultations. I had one specifically that pretty much I was just like, the mega success, where it was a student who was returning to school as an adult learner. And these were their words. They considered themselves like a tech Luddite. And so when they met with me for some more one-on-one, they communicated to me that they felt that their like tech resiliency essentially was being built up and having more confidence with completing this assignment. And then finally, the using of the digital, using digital tools and the literacies connections, specifically for bringing information literacy partnerships with the faculty member. Andrew and I have seen that now, like in our collaborations where it's like faculty are starting to like make the click. And so this using digital tools as like this entry point for making connections for other types of literacy instructions has been a super benefit for the work that we've been doing. And that is it. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I'll share a link to our slides too, because that's where the link to our lesson plan and resources are.
Thank you so much, Kate and Andrew. That was an awesome presentation. So exciting. I love all the tools that were mapped out. Also like overwhelmed by the amount of tools too. I was like, wow, so many tools. And Kate, if you wanna go ahead and take this moment to go ahead and share your screen. And just a reminder to everyone joining us today, if you have questions, go ahead and place them in the chat and just make sure that you indicate who your questions are for. And Kate, when you're ready.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, all right, so. Hi again. So the project I'm going to be talking about today is the Talking Stories, an open pedagogy collaboration and partnership. And for folks that want to check out this Digital Humanities in the Classroom project, you can totally go to this URL that is on the slide. So what I'm going to be discussing today is developed in partnership with my colleague, Dr. Michelle Scalise-Sugiyama, who's an anthropology instructor at the University of Oregon. And the collaboration that we were doing in the class that I was supporting for Michelle, this ultimately was a means for introducing students to Indigenous ecological knowledge and worldviews and fostering the decentering of white normative culture in Western education. So our project was developed as part of the Freshman Interest Group program at the University of Oregon. A FIG is a block of three interrelated courses, two lecture courses, each from a different discipline, and one credit seminar, all of which are connected by an overarching topic. The topic of Michelle's FIG is the origins of storytelling. Because storytelling emerged long before the emergence of agriculture and writing, the FIG focuses on storytelling in hunter-gatherer as opposed to agrarian and industrialized societies. The lifeways of modern hunter-gatherer peoples are the best available models for restructuring the conditions under which storytelling has emerged. Two important things that these societies teach us are that making a living by hunting and gathering requires extensive ecological knowledge, and that storytelling is one of the means used to transmit knowledge. Thus, Michelle's FIG examines storytellings in terms of ecological knowledge that is encoded. So before the beginning of the course, Michelle reached out to the Digital Scholarship Services Department that I'm a part of at UO. And she reached out to us in the summer of 2020, about 2 months before her class started. She was specifically looking for online instruction support that was taking a critical eye at digital literacy in the classroom, and also helping her out with learning some more about potential technologies that she could be utilizing for her research and instruction practices. So when Michelle's request came in through my department, my boss, the director of digital scholarship, Franny Gady, connected Michelle and me. And quite literally, like sparks between me and Michelle like flew with the excitement and creativity. And over the course of 4 to 8 weeks of working together, Michelle and I formed a deep trusting relationships as mutual experts, one in anthropology and the other in digital scholarship, with the goal of centering student learning and helping them to publish their professional writing publicly on the open web. And with each other, we made so much room for making plenty of mistakes and asking questions and sharing a project vision that could be used as a pedagogical model for Michelle's future classes, as well as others at the university. So due to the pandemic, fall 2020, the FIGs were all held remotely. So Michelle decided to assign a group project to help combat students' feelings of isolation. Since the project had to be something that the class could all do remotely, she decided that developing a website and engaging the students in content development would be key. Thus, the beginning of this Talking Stories website, which we classify as an open educational resource that explores the origins of storytelling. The site consists of three main components. One, a series of lessons, each with a dedicated page, that provides context for the encyclopedia, as well as links to relevant articles, books, and films. Two, this encyclopedia of hunter-gatherer stories and ecological knowledge that are encoded. And three, a blog featuring the research, insights, and perspectives of Indigenous and academic knowledge holders. The site is aimed at providing educators with framing and resources that they can use to incorporate Indigenous knowledge and perspectives into their course and curricula. So for the class project, each student developed an entry for the encyclopedia. Each encyclopedia entry consists of three sections. The first section reproduces a story as originally published and identifies the source, narrator, culture of origin, and the author of the entry. All stories used on the site are in the public domain or they are Creative Commons licensed. The second section identifies ecological knowledge encoded in the story itself, which is divided into six types or disciplines. We have zoology, botany, astronomy, physical geography, cultural geography, and technology. The third section provides ethnographic description of the culture and the land the stories come from, to show the context in which the story's ecological knowledge was originally used. So, and also each entry also has a reference section with links to these works cited. So the Talking Stories website does what Michelle calls double pedagogy duty. First, as an open educational resource, it provides information and resources for educators and students interested in ecological knowledge and storytelling. It also makes this knowledge available to people who might not have a means to attend college or have access to university libraries. Secondly, as a site built in part by students, it serves as a pedagogical tool for teaching digital literacy because the site is conceptualized as a story portal with new entries being added each time. Michelle teaches the FIG. The site can be used repeatedly for teaching these important skills with support from myself and my colleagues at the UO libraries. So circling back to the beginning of the collaboration with me and Michelle, so after about a month before the course started, Michelle and I were working together to beef up her WordPress skills. Also to learn how to use this super powerful theme, WordPress theme called Divi, and also Google Maps. Michelle had a little bit of WordPress experience from using it in the past, but she wanted to what she considers power up. So the time away that Michelle and I spent from technology was when we spent discussing what it means to make and give access to student work and how she and her students could reuse digital resources such as photographs and story text. Our conversations about these topics ultimately brought us to making decisions for the entire website to either use public domain or Creative Commons licensed content and license the website with a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, non-derivative license. Our ultimate goal was to make this website publicly available for reuse. So once we had worked out what we wanted for the project's intellectual property rights, Michelle and I worked together to bring other experts to support the course, what the course could offer. So since there was a research component for the class, we brought in the anthropology liaison librarian, Miriam Rigby, to support students with finding resources and how to find and make citations. I also invited our online instructional design and OER librarian, Rain Vieger, to consult with us on the course design for the 4 library instruction sessions. These 4 sessions were ultimately scaffolded in a way to build up each other. So more about that will be covered in the forthcoming slides. But Michelle and I also brought in Franny Gady, the Director of Digital Scholarship Services, and Bronwyn Maxson, our undergraduate engagement librarian, to help to come on over to the teaching party is what Michelle and I were considering it. And I brought these librarians in because I knew that we would be using a lot of technology in the classroom. And I really wanted folks that did a lot of undergraduate engagement participating in this process. And so again, all of this is done through Canvas and on Zoom. And finally, we did reach out to the University of Oregon's Intellectual Property Rights Services Department to help us develop an agreement form for students that would ultimately cover institutional compliance for FERPA and making student work available through a Creative Commons license. So after working with other experts, Michelle and I collaborated in developing some student learning outcomes that aligned with her class goals. These learning outcomes included creating a blog post using WordPress and the Divi template designs for the story, applying citations and giving attribution to all the resources used on a story entries page, reusing public domain or Creative Commons licensed digital images, making a Google map that could be embedded within the story entry, and finding textual resources using the UOL libraries to enhance or to create their story entry. So now you're probably thinking, whoa, there's a lot of learning outcomes, must have taken up so much time. Faculty usually give librarians 20 minutes or an hour to do everything because faculty have too much content to cover. Well, in this case, the incorporation of the digital literacies and working in an open pedagogical way into the classroom, it takes more than a one-shot library workshop. And Michelle understood that after having a lot of conversations and explanations with me about the reasons why. So ultimately, this class time made up just about half of the course. And some of the work students needed to complete before coming to class did require a flipped classroom approach. Specifically, when Digital Scholarship Services was introducing intellectual property rights into the classroom, myself and Franny Gady had designed a Canvas module that later built up students' knowledge base about copyright and fair use and Creative Commons before engaging in 2 activities in the 1-hour class. In the 1-hour class focused on copyright. So talking stories really wouldn't be possible without the students who aided in creating it. At its core, talking stories is an open pedagogy story, one that centers students as creators of information and not as consumers of information. Really, we took this project-based learning experience approach and an experience that we're looking forward to continuing to offer in the fall for Michelle's class. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. That was amazing. Our last presenter is Garrett Trott, and Garrett's going to be talking about transparent library instruction. So Garrett, when you get a chance, go ahead and share your screen and take it away.
Okay, so I assume everyone can see my screen.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Great. So welcome to Transparent Library Instruction. We're talking a little bit about transparency here. And some of you may be aware, but there's a session I offered last fall funded by IML's grant on transparency. It's a grant offered to Librarians of Oregon. And part of the grant was several sessions offered this last spring related to this very topic. So there's a good chance that some of you have already heard a little bit about transparency. You may have already seen it. It's kind of been emanating throughout the state of Oregon through the IML's grant received, which is great. And in the case you haven't heard about it, so this is one of the questions you're probably going to ask is what is transparency? And transparent teaching and learning methods explicitly focus on how and why students are learning course content in particular ways and how they'll use that in their lives after college. That's one of the focuses of transparency. In addition, studies have also been done that show that when faculty are more transparent with the students simply do better. And what was particularly intriguing about the study is that the transparency also particularly helped underrepresented and non-traditional students. So transparency is a critical dynamic really to enabling students who are non-traditional undergraduates to really excel in the classroom content. It works for everybody, it works for teachers as well, but particularly for non-traditional and underrepresented groups. So I'm going to be talking a little bit here about one dynamic of transparency. It's a fairly brief session. There's a lot you can talk about with transparency, but I'm going to talk about one dynamic of it, and that is learning objectives. And one of the questions you're probably going to ask yourself is, what is a learning objective have to do with transparency? That's a great question. I can just tell it's on the tip of your tongues. So one key element of transparency really is connectivity. It's important for the sake of transparency that students are able to see how your teaching connects to the learning objective of the course. That's really one of the key ideas of transparency, is being able to see those connections. And I'm going to be elaborating on this here in just a bit. But just because you can see those connections, you cannot assume the students can. Subsequently, your teaching needs to be very transparent, very clear what those connections are. And specifically, how will your session help them meet the goals and objectives of the course they're taking? So this is actually a learning objective from one of the courses here at Corbin University, English 132, is freshman English comp. It's a traditional writing class for undergraduate students, first year of writing class. And one of their objectives is students will investigate a topic, limit a thesis, and evaluate information required using traditional research tools. Excuse me, using traditional and technological research tools. So one of the questions I need to ask when I see that is, how does what I'm teaching in a one-shot session for this course connect back with this objective? So when I started hearing about this idea of transparency again in an instructional context, I began to think about how things connect. In other words, how would what I'm teaching connect back to course objectives? And of course, for me, this makes good sense. I can see those connections. But again, just because I can see them, I should not imply by any means that students or even scarcely enough faculty can see those connections. So then I began to think, like I said, I've been teaching this content for some time here at Corbin University. And granted, while I've made improvements, but just because, again, I can see how understanding how to use database connects with an ability to find good resources, which connects with good research, and how analysis of that research connects with good writing, and how an ability to write well connects with many dynamics of life, which it should value. Just because I can see those connections, I should not by any means assume that students can see them. This is actually a firm connection, in my opinion, but it has many loops between the content I'm teaching and what they want to learn. And because I've taught this topic and I'm familiar with it, again, I can see the connection, but this does not mean that students are able to see it. So again, I see the connections, but I should not assume that students can. It's my responsibility and effort towards transparency to make those connections clear or transparent, so students can understand not only why we're listening to me and why I'm teaching the session, but how these objectives connect to the needs they're going to have. So one thing that's worth noting, and this is one nice facet about working at a small university, this may not apply in all of your contexts, but one nice facet about working at Corbin University, we're fairly small, and I've been able to really develop a lot of good relationships with the teaching faculty. And subsequently, it's fairly easy to approach a faculty regarding how he or she wants this content to connect with his or her class. Just start up a conversation. It's fairly easy, fairly casual to do in the context of a small college. In part, this is really where clear objectives can play a critical role. With clear objectives, students should ideally understand the value of what they're being taught. If teaching is transparent, shouldn't be able to see how what they're being taught, again, connects back to course objectives. So I have a bad example here to share. This is a personal issue that happened last fall. This was kind of while I was doing the transparent teaching stuff. And as I was learning more about transparency, this kind of stuck out to me as a really bad example. So a colleague asked me last fall to come and just pass a basic overview of some of the resources we have. This is for an upper-level communications course. We have a research project. And they wanted me to give some basic instruction on how to use database, how to find resources for the future product. I'm sure many of you have done similar things in the various contexts which are represented here. So I talked about some of the databases that we have, some of our print resources, the fairly standard script, which I've used in a variety of contexts. However, I made no explicit connection between what I was teaching and the course assignment, nor did I make any connection between the course assignment and the course objective. I assumed students knew what I was talking about, which might be valid for some, but again, that's not a valid assessment to make in most contexts. So in this context, I'm asking myself, was my teaching transparent? I understood the connections, my colleague understood the connections, but most importantly, did the students? And unfortunately, in this context, neither the faculty member teaching the course nor I made explicit connections between these. And I would argue that we fail to make our teaching transparent in that context. And as noted earlier, when students can connect what they're being taught with what they want to learn, which is hopefully the course objectives, they tend to do better. If this is true for a standard college course with a single instructor with content related to a topic, it's got to be even more so for a one-shot session when someone talks out of the instructor and the teaching is methods-based, not necessarily content-based. So transparency, in other words, is enabling students to see how what you're teaching relates back to what they want to learn. This is the critical dynamic. The teaching in general, but I would argue the critical dynamic, especially for one-shot sessions. So again, one thing notable on how some of my colleagues work when the course is giving one shot. And to be honest, when I first thought of this, I kind of had a hard time with it, but it really does work well. And one thing that's intriguing is that many of the faculty, they'll interject their comments about every 3 to 5 minutes on how what I'm teaching connects back to course content. When I first started teaching, I kind of felt like I was being interrupted and all this stuff, and I kind of felt, hey, what are you doing? This is my turn. But it actually works really well, and I'm just surprised at how well that connects back to the idea of transparency. And it connects because the faculty's connection with students, they see them a few times a week, they grade their assignments weekly, it gives them a much better idea of how their students are progressing and the content they need to know in order to do this project well. So in a one-shot context, the faculty interjection is incredibly valuable. And subsequently, I would argue that a key dynamic making one-shot instruction session transparent is interjection from faculty. And again, why? Because the faculty knows where the students are at, both as individually and as a whole classroom. The faculty knows how the content she or he is teaching connects back to the course objective. And the faculty saw a need for the student to be aware of library resources. And that's why they asked me to come to the course. Subsequently, in the faculty's better mind, what I'm teaching is important. And very honestly, if that's not the case, you probably shouldn't be teaching in that class. But it's important for the faculty member oftentimes to make those connections in the classroom context. So in this context, it should be noted that for transparency to happen, it often takes a collaborative effort between librarian, the one doing the one-shot, and the teacher of that course. So while transparent instruction could take place when lacking this collaboration, in my opinion, it'd be much more difficult. So as I've noted, a lot of the sessions I teach are one-shot. So when I'm asked to come to class to provide an introduction to the library, and how to find stuff, where to look, who to ask, et cetera. And I just want to give a couple tips here for ways that transparency can be utilized in a one-shot session. First is simply know the learning objective of the course. That's really important because you should be able to tie what you're teaching in that course and why in there back into the learning objective of the course. Honestly, if you can't, ask the instructor, ask, why am I here? That's a very basic, very, very basic tenet that needs to be answered. Because if you can't answer it and the instructor can't answer it, there's no way the students are ever going to be able to make that connection while you're there. And subsequently, your reason for being there is who knows what. So again, know the learning objectives and be able to connect what you're teaching to those learning objectives. And on a similar vein, know the assignments which tie into using library resources. And ask, does the student understand why the assignment has value? And if you cannot connect the assignment back to the course's learning objectives, the student's not going to be able to do that either. So again, you need to be able to make those connections, because if you cannot do it, again, the student's not going to be able to make those connections either. And this is a case oftentimes where transparency is lacking. Your instruction will not be taken in with the lack of transparency. It will be your job to connect what you're teaching with the objective of the course. And again, that is what transparency is. So I want to close this with just a few resources here. The first link on the very bottom there is a document which states some strategies on transparency for numerous contexts. It's a great resource that I found. So I encourage you, if you're interested, I'm going to post it on the messages here after my session. But it's a great venue, lists a bunch of resources through which transparency can be manifested in a variety of contexts. The top one there is actually a resource called Tilt Higher Ed, and they actually have numerous resources that are related to transparency in higher education. So both of those are great resources. So I encourage you, if you're interested, look at those resources, and this would be a great place to start. Thank you.
Thank you, Garrett. That was awesome. I love transparent design. I was also part of that cohort of librarians. So it's really nice to see how this has really impacted your instruction. So thank you for sharing that with us. At this moment, we've heard from our three presentations, and we have about, I'm like looking at my clock, ooh, exactly 10 minutes left. So now we'll go ahead and open up our question and answer time. So if you do have a question for any of our presenters, please go ahead and add them to the chat and make sure you indicate who your question is for. And I think we've already got one. And so I will turn it over to Sarah, who is going to facilitate the Q&A for us. Thank you, Sarah.
Yes, thank you for your questions. And it looks like our first one is for Kate from Amy Hoffer. Curious about whether you've encountered traditional knowledge licenses as in your work so far, and also just asking anyone here if they know of examples in Oregon.
Yeah, so I related to talking stories, I'm happy you like asked this question, because the work that we, Michelle and I, were doing with our intellectual property rights office, we were having conversation, well, with Michelle and the IP office. All the way through, I was asking questions like, whose knowledge is this? How do we represent it? Should you use this knowledge? Why are you using it? And so asking those critical ethical questions. And the IP office was pretty familiar with Creative Commons, specifically because of their experience working with scientists who license their open data with Creative Commons licenses. And the second time around we do talking stories, my goal is actually to try incorporating TK labels into it in some way and educating Michelle about them. And so that's kind of what's down the pike coming for this summer, as another hey, let's think about potentially using these as part of your research and as part of your teaching practice.
Great, thank you. And for folks who have questions, if you'd like to raise your hand, you're also welcome to unmic and or unmute and ask your question live. For the first presentation, so this is for both Andrew and Kate. Amy's wondering whether, was there a digital tool that was most popular with the students? What stood out?
I think the digital tool that was popular for students, many of them were using InDesign. Using InDesign to make brochures. I had one student who was really interested in WordPress specifically, because at UO, we do have the technical infrastructure for WordPress that's managed at the like enterprise IT level instead of managed internally with the UO library, either on our own server, on our own servers, or software as a service managed by a vendor. And so I would say what was like one that was most popular was InDesign and working with WordPress.
Yeah, I'm gonna say InDesign was up there, and I was able to go to the final presentations for the course, at least the first half of the presentations. And I saw a few people attempt to use, I think it was Timeline.js. Mm-hmm. And it was some people really made it work, and some people were like, there's no way that this could actually be plugged into what I'm trying to do.
Great, thank you. Other questions for our presenters?
Well, if you have a question, you can still go ahead and enter it into the chat, but I did want to show you all my final screen of my slideshow here for you, which is some information about our upcoming social hour that we're hosting. It's going to be on Thursday at 4 p.m. And this will be hosted by Elago. And this is really a time for folks to come together and to network with colleagues. And, you know, one of the silver linings, I was talking about this before everyone entered the room, but, you know, one of the silver linings of having this remote space to meet in is that we have the opportunity to welcome people that live farther away than we usually see. So I'm really stoked about that. And if you're able to join us for this social hour, you know, that would be awesome too. And we welcome you for that. Any things I might be forgetting before we wrap up for the day? Sarah, Bronwyn, do you have anything that you would like to say?
Yeah, I'll just say that we also hope to see you on Friday for the other half of the Elago Information Literacy Summit. It starts, I believe, at 11 Pacific Daylight Time. So if you have not yet registered or were unaware, you can get yourself registered at our Elago website.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess with that, I will say thank you so much to each of our presenters today. Thank you for taking the time to share this with us. We all really appreciate it. And yeah, I will say good afternoon to you all. Have a great rest of your day. And it's kind of sunny here in Portland, Oregon. So if that's your thing, maybe you'll get outside too as well. All right, so thank you all so much for joining us. Have a great afternoon.